Hello and welcome to the HOA Show, where we discuss the news, problems, trends, and critical issues relating to life in a homeowner association. Join us every episode, and together we'll explore how to survive and thrive in the dizzying world of HOAs.
Hello and welcome to the HOA Show. My name is Ryan Gazelle. I'm joined today by Tim Klein and AJ Scott from the Klein Agency and our superstar guest, Michael Brown from Golden Bear Insurance. Golden Bear is a California admitted insurance carrier. They are a specialist in property and catastrophe insurance, right?
Yes, we are.
How long has Golden Bear been around?
41 years.
Okay. So most of the folks that are listening to this podcast are going to be homeowners, board members, and property managers. So just for their education briefly, as an insurance broker, we can't go directly to the carrier. We have to go through intermediaries to access the carriers. So they get coverage for us, quotes for us from these different carriers, Golden Bear being one of them. And Golden Bear writes quite a bit of coverage in California, right?
Yes, we do. We're coming close to $50 million in premium this year from property. The vast majority of it's in California.
It's impressive. And Michael is a vice president of Golden Bear Insurance. And how long have you been there?
Been with Golden Bear for just over 17 years.
All right.
I should be off probation any day now.
And what we're super excited about having you here for a host of reasons, but one reason is to kind of educate our board members on what does an underwriter look at? What is the carrier looking at when they get the risk, the application? What makes it a good risk? What makes it a bad risk as far as pricing goes?
And just to hop in here, this is Tim. One of the interesting things for me is giving it some perspective is in the Northridge earthquake, it just kind of felt like the carriers were fishing into a bowl and just getting a number out of their hat or something. I mean, it just didn't seem like there was any underwriting going on whatsoever. That's changed.
Very much. So prior to the Northridge earthquake coverage was included in a lot of personal lines policies. If you bought a homeowner's policy, if you bought an HO6 for a condo unit, it probably included earthquake coverage at little or no additional charge. Following Northridge, State Farm, Farmers, Allstate, all the big guys realized, wow, we wrote a lot of earthquake insurance without really realizing we were doing it. So a bunch of them just left the market abruptly. That's what prompted the California Earthquake Association, the CEA, to be developed by the state, and it also changed the way the companies who stayed in that line of business approached it. So the underwriting factors for the better earthquake risk versus the less better earthquake risk, I hate to use the term bad, are things like what the building's made out of. Wood is more flexible than concrete, so more able to resist earthquake damage than concrete brick, concrete tilt-up buildings on the commercial side. Having the footprint of the first floor be the same as the footprint of the second floor is really important.
So not cantilevering out at all.
Right. You don't want a cantilever out over space. You don't want 4x4 posts holding up a third or half of the building. It doesn't take a lot of earthquake motion to turn a vertical post into a not quite vertical post that can't hold anything up anymore. From there, we look at the building's age. Building codes change over time as we learn more and more about how different types of construction respond to earthquakes. The older a building is, the less likely that it meets current earthquake codes, makes it more vulnerable to damage. Following up on that, we look at updates that might have been done. You can go back and retrofit an older building, especially an older wood frame building, and make it almost as good as a modern wood frame building. Concrete and brick buildings are less retrofittable, if that's even a word. You can do a lot of things to them to help them not fall over during an earthquake, which is great for life safety, and I certainly encourage people to do it. But the concrete still cracks, the bricks still crack. There's a lot of repair work that will still need to be done, even though the second floor stayed above the first floor.
Quick question on that. You mentioned the retrofitting, and as you know, the city of Los Angeles has required retrofitting for so many of their associations. Those buildings, especially on the west side in the valley, that have what we call tuck-under parking. And in my experience, when we've gone back to the carriers after the retrofitting with proof of retrofitting, there really hasn't been any premium credits applied. And my impression was that that's because the purpose of the retrofitting is for life safety, not to keep the building upright.
That is absolutely the purpose of the retrofitting ordinance. You guys aren't alone. City of San Francisco has very similar rules in place. City of Oakland is discussing implementing something very similar. And the goal is to give people time to get out.
You might still have a constructive total loss.
Right.
Exactly.
Because those bracings are designed to absorb the impact. They still have to be repaired, right?
Right. Stucco is still going to crack. Windows are going to break. Plumbing is very unforgiving when the ground starts to shake. There's very little give in the plumbing for your house, especially if it's coming up out of a concrete foundation. So if the house moves one way and the foundation moves the other, you've got a pretty serious plumbing problem on your hands.
We've started to see some carriers adding the peril of ensuing water damage, specifically naming it. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that they'd kind of be on the hook anyway if the pipe breaks as a result of an earthquake? Wouldn't that be the proximate cause?
We certainly welcome them to the party. Yeah. It's been Golden Bear's position for longer than I've been there that damage caused by the earthquake is earthquake damage. Whether it's a broken water pipe, something with the electrical system, whatever it might be, including things that would normally be excluded under the earth movement exclusions. If the earthquake causes a landslide, we call that earthquake damage. If the landslide happens all by itself, that's landslide. And water damage is the same thing. If it's the result of the earthquake, it's an earthquake loss.
Oh, that's interesting. What do you think, AJ?
My thinking on that was always, if you sustain water damage sufficient to meet your percentage deductible after an earthquake, the chances are there's going to be ground motion damage to the structure as well.
How do you feel about fire following, and how difficult is it after a earthquake when there is fire damage to determine what portions of the loss are related to fire and responsibility of the underlying fire carrier?
I feel very happy not to be a claims adjuster who has to make that call. We partner with some organizations who specialize. Fire Cause Analysis in Berkeley is a good partner of Golden Bear when we have multiple contributing causes of loss. Organizations like that, they're retired firefighters, they're building inspectors in a second career, really specialists in narrow categories.
Could you explain, just before you move on, what fire following is for those of our listeners that might not know?
That's when a fire is caused by damage that was caused by an earthquake. So a gas line that ruptures or an electrical line that comes down and sparks a fire.
We had a project where there were four water heaters that broke away from the strapping, and those buildings burnt to the ground, and the carriers were subject to a $500 deductible versus the earthquake deductible. So they were very happy to see, I would say happy. They were at least relieved that they had a much lower deductible to contend with.
It can be advantageous. I've always thought it was good theater of the mind to picture the adjusting process. Two guys walking through, picking up a piece of rubble. This rubble is charred. That's yours. This rubble is not. That one's mine.
That's funny. Towing a bucket with them.
Right. No, but the way it ultimately works, we adjust the loss. We figure out what's the total amount of damage that was done. And using the best science available, we figure out which of the two carriers owes how much of it. But the goal at the end of the day is to make the insured whole. That's always going to be the target we're shooting for.
You know, the Northridge earthquake 26 years ago, the State Farm indicated they had 100,000 claims. 100,000 claims. How does State Farm or Golden Bear or any of these carriers that have some earthquake exposure deal with that magnitude claims?
Well, on the kind of entry side of it, we contract with about half a dozen independent adjusting firms scattered all around the Western United States with a contract in place that says if there's an earthquake in your territory, you promise to give us 10, 15, 20 adjusters to work on our claims before they do anybody else's. So we use force multipliers to make sure we have enough boots on the ground to get the claims taken in, prioritize them based on severity, and get people the help they need as quickly as possible. On the other end, when it comes down to writing the checks, we handle the potential influx of claims like that through an extensive network of reinsurance. Golden Bear is backed by Swiss Re, Munich Re, General Re, Partner Re, some Lloyd's syndicates, the strongest financially backed reinsurance carriers in the world. are behind Golden Bear to make sure we have the money we need when the time comes.
And explain how the reinsurance works exactly. What's the trigger for them to get their checkbook out?
When the phone rings.
Reinsurance is the insurance for the insurance companies,
right.
Essentially.
We buy insurance exactly the same way your clients buy it on a little bit larger scale. So for the earthquake line, for example, we have a treaty in place, just a insurance-y word for a contract that automatically pushes a set percentage of every policy that we write to the reinsurers. They're responsible for their percentage. We're responsible for ours. As a backstop beyond that, we have what they call catastrophe reinsurance that's triggered when we have more than four claims from a single event, whether it's a windstorm, a flood, an earthquake. When we hit that fifth claim reported for that same event, we pick up the phone to the catastrophe reinsurers and put them on notice. We may have more losses than our contract on every account can handle. Get ready.
Sort of like an umbrella carrier for most
very much like that,
insureds.
Yeah. You know, you guys have been so well known for being conservative with regard to your exposures, and more than any other carrier we've ever dealt with. And for those of you listening, what I'm talking about is they may come to us and say, we don't have any more capacity in 90401. Talk to us a little bit about your philosophy around that. I mean, we find that there's so much greed that there's some carriers that just will write anything, anytime, anywhere. And I'm relieved to see Golden Bear take this approach, because as we both know, there was a personal lines carrier that was very well known at the time of the Northridge earthquake that had far more exposure than they had ability to pay claims.
Yeah, we've unfortunately seen that phenomenon too many times. In fact, from the fire, I think it was the Camp Fire that burned Paradise, California, that drove a local Merced insurer who'd been in business for a long, long time out of business because they didn't have adequate catastrophe reinsurance. They underestimated the wildfire catastrophe risk and wrote too many policies in a very small area. My goal as the property department manager is, number one, to make sure that I don't have to go look for another job. Number two, to make sure our insureds are all taken care of properly. And three, make sure the family that owns Golden Bear gets the retirement fund they're expecting to have. Mm. We're a small family-owned company. We're playing with house money. I know all those people that own our company. Wow. And the goal is to make sure we're providing as much coverage as we reasonably can, but never jeopardizing, A, our ability to make our insureds whole, and B, the Hall family's ability to retire when they want to. And by keeping those two factors in mind, they're good checks and balances. And I just think at the end of the day, it's responsible underwriting to set limitations on ourselves beyond what our reinsurers would require or what AM Best would require of us. We always want to be just a little bit more conservative than we have to be.
Getting the rate that you need to compensate yourself for the potential risk.
Right. We try to make sure our rates are adequate without being excessive, and that our overall aggregate exposure is as much as we can reasonably do, because there is a need for the coverage in the marketplace. But going overboard, it's tempting. You go enough years without a major earthquake, it gets really tempting to think it'll never happen again.
And that's what we saw.
We all know that it will.
And that's what we saw a few years ago. I mean, up until last year, really, we were seeing, you know, the lowest rates we'd had in a long, long time, and carriers were coming in with ridiculously low pricing. And that's confusing, I think, to a lot of our managers and our board members. Well, we haven't had an earthquake in a long, long time, 25 years. How come all of a sudden our rates were half what they were 2 years ago, and now they're double?
I liken it to a pendulum. Rating in the insurance industry is always in motion. We never stay in one place for very long. So as carriers look at their loss history in a particular line, and California earthquake is a great example, boy, there hasn't been an industry-changing event in a long time. Northridge was the last one. We've had earthquakes. Ridgecrest had a 7.1 the day after, a 6.4 in July this year. Napa just a couple of years ago had a very strong earthquake center just south of the city of Napa, but they weren't, in either case, industry game changers. They were in fairly remote areas, and the insured loss was very minimal. a lot of uninsured loss. So buy the insurance. You have to go back to the Northridge event to see the last time the insurance industry was really hurt by a California earthquake. And there are a certain number of carriers out there, and more than just carriers, some managing general agents, where a carrier will hire a group of people to underwrite on their behalf and issue policies for them. Generally, we'll see this with a carrier that's not, say, familiar with California earthquake, but they want to dip their toe in the water. So they'll hire people in California who know the area and the hazards and make an arrangement for them to place business. It's really easy for those folks to drive the price down a little bit too far, because they're not going to be the ones that have to pay the losses. They're dealing with a commission situation. They've got targets to hit, and you get into sort of a production underwriting mode in some cases. I don't want to besmirch managing general agents, because
that makes sense, though.
In certain perspectives, I am one from time to time, but there's not the same skin in the game that you get when you're dealing with a carrier who's writing directly. And as I said, for Golden Bear, we worry a lot about that bit of skin in the game. We want to make sure we're here for the long term. The second generation of the Hall family is running the company now. The third generation are just starting to get out of college and enter the insurance industry. So my job is to make sure that Generation 3 has just as robust a company to take over as Generation 2 did a few years back.
But back to the point about what's changed, why are the premiums all of a sudden jumping up when we haven't had any earthquakes?
Well, we've had a couple. We haven't had serious damage from them on a grand scale. Ridgecrest did a great job of reminding us that earthquakes can happen in unexpected places. We had two earthquakes in and around Ridgecrest that were near the Garlock Fault, but the ground motion was perpendicular to the Garlock Fault, which was unusual. You have to go back to 1994 and Northridge to see the last time we had a major event on a fault we didn't know about. I always picture seismologists breaking out a colored pencil. It was about here. We'll draw a line right there. We can still be surprised as pressures that build up along the San Andreas plate boundary express themselves in interesting ways. All the little faults that are scattered around California are the result of stress along that San Andreas fault, where the San Andreas is sturdy enough not to move under the pressure that's there, but some other parts of either the Pacific or North American plates give way to try and relieve some of the stress. The other feature that plays in is the commodity pricing element of property catastrophe insurance. I mentioned reinsurance before. Everybody who's in the property catastrophe game buys some amount of reinsurance, some more than others. And that pool of reinsurance capital for property is finite. There are only so many players in that game, and they only have so much capital to allocate that direction. So as you see global catastrophes mounting, and this is wildfires in the West, earthquakes anywhere in the world, hurricanes and floods anywhere in the world, it's all reinsured out of that same bucket. As the bucket starts to get drained by paying losses, those reinsurers charge more for that same capacity next year than they charged last year. They have to refill their tank. And when our cost per dollar of doing business goes up, some of that has to get passed through to the consumer.
That makes sense. You mentioned the Ridgecrest quake and how you really weren't aware of a potential new fault just above the Garlock Fault. So how does that factor into the new modeling software? You use a risk modeling software to calculate the potential risk of any given association, right? And you're constantly gaining new data. Is it just a modeling system and you plug in the address and all of a sudden it spits it out? Here's the risk.
Pretty close. The first thing that the software we use does is what we call geocoding. So it converts a street address to latitude, longitude coordinates, and then plots that coordinate on a map from the U.S. Geological Survey that tells us what we know about the soil conditions in that spot, what the slope is there landslide potential there or not, and then what the soil liquefaction potential is. Liquefaction is just a fancy word for when dirt acts like water. You can picture a bowl of sand. You could set a rock on top of the sand and it will just sit there, be perfectly fine. If you shake the bowl, the rock will sink to the bottom and the sand will fill in around the top. So So if you've built your house on soil that is particularly sandy or particularly wet, that same phenomenon can happen. Think of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. They didn't build that tower to fall over sideways. They just built it on high liquefaction soil with an inadequate foundation, so it's gradually tipping over. The Millennium Tower in San Francisco, same deal. 100-some-story condo building, it's brand spanking new, it's beautiful, and it is gradually tipping over.
Gary.
It really is.
Michael, can you talk a little bit? We spend a lot of energy working on valuations. And could you talk a little bit about the statement of values? And if you could also kind of dovetail a discussion on building ordinance and sure. How that might impact values?
Well, first off, I want to say that your team does a great job of putting together the submissions for property coverage that come our direction. The information we need is clearly presented, and we really appreciate that you do invest some time in determining if the values make any sense or not. We see too many cases where the same people have owned a property or the same association has been operating on a property for 10, 15, 20 years, and they've never updated their values on their insurance. Mm. They're still using the same limit they did when it was built, which doesn't take into account the fact that the cost of materials changes year over year, the cost of labor goes up. As wages go up in the marketplace, the cost of having work done goes up. We think it's vital for any insured to at least periodically take a good look and make sure that the values you're presenting are adequate. If you have that constructive total loss scenario, we want to make sure you have enough money to rebuild, and you certainly want to make sure you have enough money to rebuild. It doesn't really benefit anybody in the long run to have inadequate values. And in the building ordinance scenario, that's coverage that comes in three pieces. Coverage A would be for the undamaged portion of the building. So if you've got a 100-unit homeowners association all in one tower, and the earthquake happens and 51% of the building is damaged, 49% is not, the local building codes may say that damage is too extensive to do a repair. You have to tear it down and replace it. Every municipality has a threshold at which they're going to say repairing that just isn't good enough. It needs to be replaced. They're all a little bit different. I've seen them as low as 45%. I've seen them up to 60%, but in that neighborhood. When that happens, the earthquake insurance policy, without any endorsements on it, is going to say we will pay for the value of the building that was damaged by the earthquake, in this case, 51%. But you have to tear down the undamaged portion, and there's no coverage for that because it wasn't earthquake damage. By adding the building ordinance endorsement, it's kind of the golden ticket to turn a partial loss into a total loss. If you need the rest of the building limit because the law says you have to tear down the building, it's available if you have that endorsement. The other two pieces are demolition cost. Again, the cost of demolishing and hauling away debris of the damaged portion of the building is included in the policy. Tearing down the undamaged portion of the building and hauling that debris away would only be covered if you had the building ordinance endorsement. And the third piece is increased cost of construction. As you're rebuilding your structure or even repairing, if the repairs are significant, the city may come in and say, you know, the building codes have changed since this building was originally built. In order to get your permits signed off, you have to make these improvements that didn't exist before. Again, the base policy is going to say we will rebuild the building you had within the policy limit. Any additional stuff you didn't have that you now have to, there's no coverage without the endorsement that says we'll pick up to whatever dollar value worth of increased cost of construction improvements.
That's about the clearest I've ever heard that illustrated.
Yeah. Wow.
And some carriers, depending on how old the building is, won't be able to include the building ordinance, right?
Michael, you mentioned labor costs, and I think it's so important for us to be aware in California, as we've passed legislation to increase the minimum wage, that's going to have an impact on a lot of these workers and tradesmen. And I'm sure HOAs are seeing it already in a lot of their contracts, but at the time of rebuilding, that's going to carry some weight. But also, what kind of demand surge would you Do you have any sense of, I know it's an unfair question.
Demand surge is an interesting animal. So for the non-insurance nerds in the audience, demand surge is what we call the spike in the cost of doing business following a disaster. Following Hurricane Katrina, a sheet of plywood at Home Depot was going for $75. It was $6 or $8 the day before the hurricane. Following Northridge, we saw similar spikes in the cost of building materials, the cost of labor. They will bring in construction crews from all over. In the case of Katrina, there were people from North Dakota who were getting in their trucks and driving to Louisiana because there was work there and they could get paid really well to do it because it's cheaper to pay a premium on the labor and materials than it is to let the clock run on the business interruption losses. So it's a balancing act. So following disasters, you see demand surge as low as 4 or 5% increases. If it's a bad enough, wide enough spread disaster, a Hurricane Katrina, a Northridge earthquake, 20 to 25% increases in overall costs are not unusual. So it's important to consider that sort of thing also when you're picking your policy limits. And leave yourself some wiggle room if you're pretty sure $5 million rebuilds the building in a perfect world. Maybe you need a little cushion on the top end of that just to make sure, because it won't be a perfect world following the earthquake.
You know, the challenge, I think, and there are many governing documents, many sets of CC&Rs and bylaws that require the board of directors to get three bids. And in the Northridge earthquake, you're lucky to get one bid. So without competition, it's likely it's going to cost more, because there's really no incentive to lowball it, because you've really got no other place to go to. You've got one contractor, hopefully, that can do the work.
It's high school economics all over again. Demand is increasing, supply is contracting, price goes up.
It's a seller's market.
Exactly.
They're selling the contracting, who wants to pay the most to get it.
And I can also say, regarding those contracts and the provisions within them, it's not at all unusual for provisions like that to be set aside during a major disaster. The requirement to get three competitive bids, for example, if you can't get three bids, no court is going to say you did the right thing by not fixing the building,
right?
Because you couldn't get the bids. They're going to say, get a bid that's as reasonable as you can, do your due diligence, and get the work
forward.
Done.
And for the benefit of the listener, you know, there's a city in Los Angeles County that has a parking issue, and they have an ordinance that says if it's a 20-unit building with two bedrooms, you must have 40 parking spaces. That is to say, you must have one parking space for every unit in the building. And this particular city has
two parking spaces.
No, one parking space for every bedroom. So
it's a two-bedroom.
You gotta have two spaces. Unfortunately, it's a conversion, many of conversions in that particular city where there isn't adequate parking to meet the current ordinance. And there's an example. If there was a loss at that building and more than 51% of the building is damaged, you'd have to bring the building up to code, which would require, in a 22-unit building, 40 parking spaces, which means they'd have to tear the building down, go down another story, add another layer of parking.
Dig deeper.
We have seen that scenario. And sort of the other side of that, we've seen in some coastal communities, ordinance go in saying that new construction can't exceed two stories tall so that you're not obstructing the view of people across the street from you. If you had a three-story building that was badly damaged, you may not be able to rebuild to three stories.
In the Northridge earthquake, we found the code upgrade, the conformance with current building code, was running about 10 to 11%. And I know that's a ridiculous number to throw out because it's really predicated on how new the building was that was damaged. And newer buildings potentially would be closer to the current code, although we saw some circumstances where the code had actually changed in the time between the event itself and when they got ready to pull permits. So it's a little challenging there. But what we're concerned about is in 2000, many of the cities in California adopted the International Building Code, which requires residential fire sprinklers. And residential fire sprinklers, we think, is going to run $12,000 to $15,000 per unit. So in addition to the other code changes you might be having to address, the seismic changes in the footings and so forth, we're concerned about those additional costs related to the residential fire sprinklers.
The sheer magnitude of code changes that go on is staggering. Don't forget the Americans with Disabilities Act code changes. Those can come back to haunt you when you're getting your building permits. Generally speaking, the more work you're doing, the more codes they're going to ask you to comply with. If you're doing a $25,000 repair or rehab job, you're probably only going to have to spend 10 or 15% of that towards code upgrades. But in a scenario where you have that constructive total loss on the building, they will come in and treat it like it's new construction in many cases, and you'll have to meet all of the existing codes, which can be a challenge.
We think one of the more sobering experiences of purchasing earthquake insurance is having the insured sign a statement of values. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the statement of values and how it impacts a policyholder at the time of loss.
Sure. So in many property insurance scenarios, the carrier will apply coinsurance, which is, again, fancy insurance ease for letting the insured have some skin in the game. What that clause in the policy means is you've disclosed, you the insured, a value for your building. We assign a coinsurance percentage of 80, 90, or 100% through our negotiation with the broker and with the insured. In the event of a loss, if the amount that we determine the real replacement cost value of the building is out of sync with that ratio. So if you've reported your building is worth $800,000 with 80% coinsurance and we find out it's $1 million replacement cost, nothing bad happens because $800,000 is 80% or more of the real number. And that means we're all happy, we'll settle the claim, life goes on. If it's less than that coinsurance percentage, the insurer is allowed to reduce the amount they pay for the loss based on how far the value of the building was below the real replacement cost. Yes, to exactly the same ratio. Now, with catastrophe insurance, in many cases, Golden Bears being one of them, we waive that provision. We're aware that demand surge is a likely component in any loss settlement. I don't know how to predict it, and I've been doing this for a while, so I certainly don't expect our insureds to know how much do we pad the replacement cost for demand surge. So as a shield for us to make sure we're hopefully getting adequate values and understand the risk that we're taking on, we do ask that the insured provide us with a statement of values that they've signed, that they're representing these to be as true and accurate as they can make them be. We make those numbers part of our policy. So if you've got building coverage, contents coverage, and some business interruption or association dues, and you express each of those with a value on your statement of values, each of those values becomes the limit for that line of coverage in the policy.
The maximum amount that
Yeah, the most that you could recover for building is the value you said the building was worth.
So for example, even though you may have purchased $10 million worth of earthquake coverage, you can't move that around willy-nilly. It's going to be really dependent on what is listed on the statement of values, and the carrier in most cases won't pay more than the value that's on that statement of values for that building or structure.
Right. And there are kind of two ways to assist with that. One is a margin clause endorsement. This will be a number between 105%, I see them up to 125% sometimes, and it allows you to borrow, if you will, I'm making air quotes, you can't see them, from another line of coverage. It doesn't increase the total policy limit, but if you needed 10% more building than your building limit, you could borrow it from the contents or the loss.
From another building.
It's a fudge factor.
From another line item in your policy. I wanted to follow up a little bit on margin clause, which is a very useful tool, and a lot of carriers will offer them. Sometimes you have to ask, and they're, in most cases, either at no additional charge or very minimal additional premium to get that wiggle room around your limits. The next kind of quantum leap in the insured's favor would be a blanket loss limit. Like Golden Bear offers one. I know a lot of our competitors do as well.
On earthquake?
On earthquake coverage. Again, generally not an expensive addition. In our particular case, we only offer it when we feel like the values presented are realistic. If we think the building value is marginal to submarginal, we're very unlikely to offer a big margin clause or blanket limits because we're trying not to encourage people to underinsure. If you give us values that are realistic or present us with an insurance appraisal that says your number is right, we can certainly run with that and make those options available.
You know, one of the challenges, I think, for writing common interest developments in California is with regard to the earthquake coverage, many carriers have what we call a pointer provision. That is something, a provision in the policy that points to an outside contract. In this case, for homeowners associations, it's the CC&Rs. And our challenge is we find CC&Rs are typically poorly drafted and commonly do not really help us in terms of identifying what structural elements should or should not be covered, or that the association is responsible for fix, repair, and maintain. And I say fix and repair and maintain because oftentimes earthquake coverage isn't even mentioned in the governing documents. So I'm wondering your philosophy in terms of scope of coverage. And I'll tell you our bias going in is we'd like to see it as illustrative as possible under the earthquake insurance, so we don't have as much reliance on the CC&Rs. But I'd love to hear your comments.
My experience with CC&Rs has been exactly the same. They tend to be documents, especially for an association that's been around for any length of time. They're documents that have never been updated. Nobody has looked at them since 1957 when some attorney typed it up for them.
For the developer.
For the developer. Our policy does contain that kind of pointer provision. So when there's a question of is this, that, or the other element covered, if it's not clear, we point back to the CC&Rs to be the arbitrator, but we can get around the fact that we know that document is unlikely to be ideal for our needs by scheduling on the policy the specific properties that are exposed to loss.
Or adding an endorsement.
Or adding an endorsement.
Broadening endorsement, the 0407.
Yeah, Golden Bear has a good one.
Right.
We have...
So unendorsed, it's going to point to the CC&Rs. Once you endorse it, then you're just making it clear.
Right. We have three versions of that condominium homeowners association endorsement. The first one says we cover exactly what the CC&Rs require the association to insure and nothing else. And we have one that'll cover anything you need us to cover up to a sublimit. So unit owners improvements and betterments and paved surfaces, all that stuff. We can assign a single sublimit, list out what those properties are for X dollars. And then the Cadillac version, if you will, says we cover whatever's listed on our policy as covered regardless of ownership, which allows the association to offer to insure things like permanent fixtures inside the units and that sort of thing.
And that's only covered or offered if the values
Again,
are adequate.
Right. It's all those things. Anything permanently attached in insurance terms becomes part of the building. So if the building values appear adequate based on our experience and what we know about the industry, we're happy to throw that sort of endorsement in. If the values appear a little sketchy, we'll probably push back and say we'd be happy to do that, but this number is going to need to increase to accommodate it.
Regardless of ownership, it's so interesting how those three words carry so much weight. And literally, it makes up for a vast number of issues on the CC&Rs because it says affirmatively there's going to be coverage for certain structural elements. We have a lot of pushback from boards of directors over this issue. You know, why should we insure more than what the CC&Rs require? Or if we're only responsible for repairing and replacing certain things, why are we doing something broader than that on the master policy? And my concern is that when we've done studies in homeowners associations, we find that one out of every four owners has no insurance at all. And of the 75% of the remaining, only half on average buy earthquake insurance. And if the Department of Insurance statistics are right, it's even a lower number, maybe 14 to 17%. So you have the majority of homeowners have no individual earthquake insurance to supplement the master policy. So our philosophy has always been, shoot, let's get as long as the coverage can be, you know, affirmatively written, let's get as broad as possible so that if there is that many homeowners that don't have coverage, they don't have to walk away.
Right. And from my perspective, I always look at it as the policy is going out for an association. Who are the members of the association? They're the unit owners.
Yeah.
So if we can protect those unit owners through the association policy, there's some buying power there. Those policies tend to have pretty big values relative to the HO6 policy that the individual unit owner is going to go after. Higher premium and higher limits tend to mean you get a little negotiating ability.
Economy of scale.
Economies of scale.
Yeah.
We can probably do nearly as good a job for each of those unit owners by grabbing those permanently installed fixtures and improvements and betterments items and lumping them into the association policy as they could do on their own. And in the event that they didn't take that step and get their own coverage, then the association can provide a little backstop, and the unit owners are paying the premium ultimately anyway through their association dues. So it's...
Yeah. The nice thing about Golden Bear's Cadillac endorsement is it just broadens the building definition to include these features. Now it's going to consider building not just the structural elements, the shell of the building, but it's also going to include wall, floor, and ceiling finishes, appliances, other permanently installed built-ins. So rather than the sublimit option, which some carriers, you got to be careful, because when they designate a value for interior improvements and betterments, built-ins, permanently installed fixtures, sometimes they'll break it out of the building limit and it will actually reduce the amount of general building coverage available to the association. So that's something for boards to watch out for and make sure if there's a separate value listed for those interior improvements, is that, can we still move that around? Because in a major or total loss, you might need all of it for the building common areas and you want to have that flexibility. But in a partial loss, you want to be able to collect as much as you can. And by having that broadest Cadillac endorsement, so to speak.
And at the end of the day, the board's ultimate responsibility is to maintain the resale value of the homes,
right?
The real estate value. And if, you know, 30, 40, 50, 75%, as Tim suggests, of the owners don't have personal lines coverage, if you rebuild the structure itself and the interiors are not nice, nobody's going to be able to sell their value or their unit for what they want to.
Yeah.
Right. I think unrepaired units or units that are repaired back to the unfinished floors, walls, and ceilings is going to do one thing for certain, and that is going to bring down the comps of every other unit in the project.
Oh, yeah.
So, if the board's goal is to maintain the real estate values in the project, they failed by inadvertently not having adequate protection.
Well, speaking of the kind of boards and ways they can avoid shooting themselves in the foot, I spoke with the owner of a company in Northern California that we work with, the fire cause analysis I mentioned before. And one point he asked me to bring up was that following an earthquake or any major damaging event to an association, don't repair or remediate too quickly. Let the adjuster get on scene, do their investigation, take their pictures. If you get plumbers, carpenters, drywall guys, whomever, out before that has happened, you may cover up or destroy evidence that would have allowed you to recover more from your insurance. We really need to see it raw.
That gets tough, though. I mean, I can imagine, after a large earthquake, getting somebody in to take pictures fast enough, but still wanting to, A, stop the water as soon as possible. You got to get the plumber out there to stop the water from causing further damage, and mold grows in as little as, 12 hours or something, 24? So it's kind of a fine line for them.
There's a bit of a balancing act, and we'd certainly encourage turn off the water, shut off the gas, give some thought to flipping the switch on the electrical panel as well, if you have significant damage, because any of those left alone could exacerbate the loss. Minor plumbing damage behind a wall or under a slab, if the water's left on for the days or a week it might take to get the professionals out to do a thorough evaluation of the damage, could exacerbate things. So certainly take basic steps to preserve the property, protect yourselves a little bit, but to the extent that it's possible, leave the scenario as raw as you can until the first adjuster gets out. I said, we have contracts with a number of firms. You get a lot of boots on the ground. We will triage based on who's reporting the most damage, get people on the ground in those places first. People where windows broke and things fell off of shelves, we can probably get to tomorrow or the next day. And the goal is to make sure we've gathered as much information as possible.
So ideally, they'd be looking at an adjuster on site in 24 hours or so. 24 to 48
hours. To the extent that we
that you can.
Right. If
depending
we're in
on
that,
how bad the damage is.
If we get 300 claims in 24 to 48 hours should be doable. We have contracts in place to get us enough bodies in any given region. If the roads are passable and the airport's open, we can make things happen pretty quickly. The more widespread the damage is, the longer that's going to take, just because our people have to come in from somewhere else. And if roads are closed or airports are closed, that gets harder.
I tell people to be very careful what they wish for, though, in terms of that repair, because as you know, in New Zealand, they had an event that was within 6 months of the initial event. And we always are concerned that if you get the adjuster out there and get it all documented, you might have a follow-up aftershock that does even more damage that's after the 168-hour or one-week definition of an occurrence, where you may have a second deductible applied. And I know that seems unusual or rare, but almost all these carriers now, including Golden Bear, I believe, there's a definition of an occurrence is the initial event and any subsequent aftershock that occurs within that 168-hour period.
Yeah, the New Zealand was kind of the confluence of as many things that can go wrong. Well,
yeah.
They discovered that parts of New Zealand have very high liquefaction potential in the soil. They didn't know that before. They had a series of earthquakes over about a six-month spread. So in the case of a Golden Bear policy, we do use that 7-day timer. So from the first event that causes damage, we go out 7 days. That's all one loss. So bad news is there's another deductible if there's another loss later. The good news is our policy comes with an annual aggregate limit. So if you had somewhere approaching the full limits loss in that first event, there's an opportunity to circle back to us and negotiate to buy back your limit. Essentially, we'll write a new policy starting with the reconstruction phase moving forward. So yes, there would be another deductible calculation there, but there's also another opportunity limit to get the limit reinstated.
You know, the California Earthquake Authority was born in 1996. Insurance Commissioner Chuck Quackenbush was really faced with an abysmal real estate market. No one could sell or refinance because no carrier wanted to write the peril of earthquake. And so fortunately, he, along with the California legislature, developed the CEA. But one of the challenges that we've had with the CEA is the fact that there's a provision in that policy that says that if they don't have adequate funds to pay the claim, that they're going to prorate the payments based on what they anticipate the eventual payouts to be. I just wondered, because you're the California earthquake expert, I'd be curious to know your opinion, Michael Brown.
I know two or three people that would argue about that point, but that's not an unusual provision in a pooled risk scenario. There are organizations out there that sell commercial versions of earthquake insurance using that same model. We will buy as much reinsurance limit as we can in the marketplace, and you will get your pro rata share of whatever limit we can buy up to a maximum of your policy limit. In the case of the Earthquake Authority, though, they have been collecting premiums since 1996. They have paid very few losses, relatively speaking, over that time. They have an abundance of capital, and they're buying reinsurance in the same markets that we go to. Swiss Re provides them with a startlingly large amount of reinsurance every year, enough that I question how much they let us have. It's not fair. But money talks, and the Earthquake Authority has a lot of premium dollars to play with. So while that provision does exist in their policy, at this stage of the game, I don't know that it's a huge concern because they've got quite a war chest that they've built up.
I have to say, I mean, my earthquake insurance is with the CEA. So despite my concerns about that provision, I think probably still for many of us, it's the best choice.
Under Glenn Pomeroy, the last few years, they have done a great job of modernizing their offering. Their website now allows you to go in and they have sliders for limits, for deductible, for optional endorsements. You can, to borrow Progressive slogan, you can kind of name your price. What's more important to you, the best coverage available or the lowest price? You can customize things quite a bit. They offer deductibles down to 5% in some areas. They've done a really good job under Mr. Pomeroy of making themselves relevant.
No, that's okay.
Market.
I think they've said that they have the wherewithal to sustain, what, 3 Northridge earthquakes occurring simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I think that's been their party line the last few years because of their capital and their reinsurance protection.
Remember, they've been collecting premium now for 23, almost 24 years. They're ready.
The other interesting thing is, in our opinion, the most important coverage that an individual unit owner can buy is earthquake loss assessment coverage. Because in our estimation, there is going to be a special assessment. No association has adequate funds, or very few, that can cover the deductible.
We often do sort of the mental arithmetic looking at an HOA or condo association submission asking for a 25% earthquake deductible to get the premium down a few more dollars. If you have a $10 million policy limit, $10 million value, and a 25% deductible, your deductible is $2.5 million. Divide by the number of doors, that's the assessment everybody's going to get if there's a total loss level earthquake. And I don't think boards and certainly unit owners at large necessarily think that through. Very easy to get tied up in the idea that we can shave 5 or 10% off of our premium by taking a higher deductible.
And as if we talked earlier, if so many, such a large percentage of homeowners don't have any coverage, let alone earthquake loss assessment coverage, then it's going to be a larger financial burden for them. And, you know, I often hear people say, gee, we have a number of people on fixed income. And I said, that's an unfortunate circumstance, but earthquake insurance is so important, especially for someone on fixed income who can't afford to walk away their own investment. The comment I was going to make regarding loss assessment coverage is my understanding is that the insurance carriers that are all writing for the CEA will use their own adjusters to adjust the CEA losses per the CEA guidelines. And what I thought was interesting about the Northridge earthquake is there were certain carriers that were really strict with regard to that loss assessment claim. That is to say, they'd say, how much of this portion of the special assessment is related to building ordinance? Well, we don't cover building ordinance. Well, how much is bad debt? Because you anticipated certain owners walking away. Well, we don't cover bad debt. And now with regard to the California Earthquake Authority, what percentage of this is related to the swimming pool and the spa and the common area rec building? Because those are all excluded on the CEA policy. So I think it's really important that owners prepare. Just getting loss assessment coverage is a good first start. But there's going to be a lot of out-of-pocket for them.
Yeah, it's important to have a plan of how you're going to deal with that, whether it's scoping out some financing options kind of ahead of time. You have enough equity in your unit that you could take a second mortgage to cover the assessment and let yourself pay it back over 5 years or however long. Personal loans, that sort of thing, are available. FEMA's got some low-interest loans that they make available to disaster victims.
In the Northridge earthquake, it was fortunate enough that the Small Business Administration stepped in and offered Homeowners Association low-interest loans. At that time, low-interest loans was 3 to 4%, amortized over 20 years. But they were capped at $1.5 million, despite how large the association may be. So the federal government won't be there necessarily to bail out HOAs either. They may have to go to a private lender, but there are alternatives, as you suggest.
And with, I don't want to say minimal effort, with some not onerous effort, the associations could scope out what their alternatives would be. You can contact FEMA and find out, for an association like ours, following a disaster, what might we be eligible for? You can contact the Small Business Administration. They'll know what their guidelines are. They don't invent guidelines after the earthquake. So you can get a sense of where you might be able to go and what that might cost. And maybe that's a budgetary line item. Every year we're going to squirrel away $20. So we have a little fund to help absorb the cost of financing if we ever have to.
And bottom line, that recovery is, however difficult it might be to come up with the deductible after an earthquake, it would be a heck of a lot harder to come up with the uninsured amount for associations that don't have this coverage.
You're suggesting that it's not just a deductible, it's 100% of the loss.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Michael. It's been illuminating.
And my pleasure.
A lot
for
of
having
fun
me.
Talking insurance with the fellow insurance nerds.
They're
Tim,
hard
anything
to find.
Else to add?
We're thrilled to have you, Michael, and we are such a big fan of Golden Bear and all of the things that you do and bring to the marketplace, and giving up your time to speak with us today is really...
I'm very happy to. We're glad to have you guys as partners, too.
And as we end our episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that if you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for topics that you'd like to learn more about, you can email us at feedback@hoashow.org. Join us next time on The HOA Show.
To share or subscribe to The HOA Show, visit us at hoashow.org. There, you'll be able to listen to other episodes, find helpful resources relating to HOAs, provide feedback, submit questions, and check out other great stuff. The HOA Show podcast has been made possible by the contributions of Klein Agency Insurance Brokers, leaders in the community association industry. The views and opinions expressed by the podcast, its presenters and guests, do not constitute legal advice. For more information on how the topics and discussion apply to you, please consult with your own legal counsel.